You know what I really want right now?
What do you want?
Corn nuts.
What?
That's a random.
It is so random. Like, I haven't had corn nuts in, like, forever. And then I was just like, I want ranch corn nuts.
Do you remember?
Or the barbecue ones.
How stale they are.
Are they stale? I don't remember that. I just remember, like, in high school eating those and being like, oh, these are really good. People would share them with me. I never bought them. But, like, I mean, this is decades ago. And now, like, right now, I was just like, oh, I want to be eating corn nuts right now.
Wow.
They're incredibly salty. So you might be dehydrated needing some salt. But they're also, they tend to be kind of stale. They're extra crunchy. And then they're like that hard, oh, right, this is.
I'm going to break my tooth.
Yeah.
Type of thing. Okay. Yeah.
Aren't they just dried hominy?
Yes, I think so. But
maybe they're like the right size for that.
I think that's what they are.
They're like staled out for something else. Like I remember getting a whole bunch of Mountain Man corn nuts and they called them something else. And those tended to be great all the time. Mm. And then I went to the like corn nuts. I was like, oh, these are really hard to chew.
Yeah.
They're genuinely too much. Doesn't mean you can't crave them. Crave on. But just be aware that like when you have them, be like, your memory of what they were decades ago versus now might be a little different.
Okay, well now I gotta go get some.
Now you really want them.
Now I have to
Let's
see.
Pause. Let's come back to this. Let Emily get her corn nuts. We'll come back and record.
I think this would be an audio nightmare for many listeners. Including me.
Including you. Especially you.
I would mute myself.
Oh my God. This is The Devil You Don't Know.
It's season 3, episode 1. We're talking about noise today. I am Don Early, and I am, as always, accompanied by Emily.
Hello!
And Jeremy.
Hey!
And I heard from Brendan. Brendan Foster. Today, you'll get to listen to this interview. He is a co-host of SAR Power, which I think is very cleverly named, SAR Power Podcast, T-S-A-R. Right? You're like, star? Did you mean
not quite like, star power?
Yeah. Star?
Got it.
Star?
Love it. Czar power.
Czar power.
And the history of, I'm still not going to get this right. Sakartvelo podcast? I'm not sure.
How do you spell that one?
S-A-Q-A-R-T-V-E-L-O.
Yep.
I'm going with Sakartvelo.
Sakartvelo.
I don't know. The emphasis is probably on the wrong syllable, but it's somewhere in the mix there. Anyway, he's a podcaster. He's been doing it for a while, and he approached me with some ideas about noise music. And Jeremy, I played him your question about noise around, you know, that Tool.
Yeah.
So you said there was the Tool album. So I didn't know if that was right. I thought what he was going to be talking about was something else entirely. We'll get into this interview. Brendan Foster talking about noise music, the occult, demons, and all that within. So let's get into it.
Sweet. Cool.
Well, thank you, Brendan, for joining the Devil You Don't Know podcast. I'm very excited to hear what you're excited to talk about today. We chatted slightly on the history podcast Discord server, and I just kind of threw out, hey, I would love to talk to anyone in this field who has anything related to the devil or devil adjacent topics. And you tell me, What came to your mind?
What came to my mind was a Substack essay I'd recently written. It's called, Noise Music Dissolution and Disunity with the Divine, A Theory of Disorder in Music. And that is from my Substack, invented organs.substack.com, where if you're interested in, probably a lot of your audience will be interested in this, I talk about noise music. I talk about body horror. I talk about Junji Ito, a whole host of things that just pique my interest as a morbid person who's also trying to put an intellectual veneer over everything.
Got it. Well, tell me about your podcast, your background, and who you are in that space.
Yeah. So anyway, my name's Brendan. I'm from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I don't really actually, this does really nothing to do with what we're going to talk about today, but I'm the co-host of Star Power, which is a podcast where Roberto Toro and I rank all of the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin. And I joked earlier, appearing on this podcast is not going to help our reputation as the most evil Rexy pod on the air. And besides that, I do behind the scenes work for Roberto's other podcast, The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. Once in a while, my voice appears on there, but not often. And it's funny that this happened now, because the rule is with Tsar Power is I'm not allowed to do any research ahead. I have to go in cold, which I violate all the time because I love 20th century American history. And I was reading something about McCarthyism. And of course, the Soviet Union had to pop up there. But we just had a ruler named Vsyatoslav the Sorcerer, who, according to the primary Russian chronicles, which are not super reliable, but it's our only primary source, he was a shape-shifting sorcerer who could transform into a deer, an elk, an eagle, a wolf, and a serpent.
That's amazing.
So whichever monks in the 13th century wrote that down, probably not a huge fan of this guy. They literally demonized him.
Yeah. Yeah. We are quite familiar with that in the realms of history.
Yeah. Elaine Pagel's book, Origins of Satan. I saw that you did a read through of that.
Yeah.
Which I was doing some extra research and I noticed that her name popped up. I haven't read her, but now I'll definitely give that book a read.
It's good. She is also super well known for her work on the Gnostic Gospels. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's her main forte, I think.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. So I was telling my co-hosts about kind of the direction of where we're going to go this season, doing more interviews. And I was talking mm-hmm. about you and your idea about noise music and noise theory and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's just a subject I know zero about. So I'm very excited yeah. to talk to you about mm-hmm. that. But I'm going to play a clip right now. This is what Jeremy was wondering if this was all about. So hang tight and let me know what you think about this.
There's a track on Tool's album from 15 years ago.
Yes.
Where I know what you're talking about. Their electronic equipment while they were taking a break turned itself on. And they couldn't figure out why. It just was on. And so they hit record and let whatever sound was coming through the amplifiers be recorded. And it's got guttural sounds and different tones. And they believed it was a demonic connection. Or at least that's what they put in the album, right? That they're like, here's the voice. But like, there was a whole thing that was up and around that because several of the people came in afterwards. They're like, me too. And like, it's also happened to me. And so there was this level. So that's where my head was going. Is that about right?
Yeah, actually, it's not far off. One of the main ideas I had was in noise music, noise musicians and musicians in other genres like black metal and grindcore, which I was going to talk about a bit. They prefer to engage with equipment when it's breaking down, is basically. And this is also present in glitch music as well. The German band Oval. It's probably one of the more famous glitch ambient production teams ever. They had a method of making ambient music. This was on their album 94 Discount, where they would take CDs and they would draw on them with black Sharpies. And then they would put them in a CD player and then record it skipping.
Huh.
And this is how a lot of glitch music works. It's in the realm of focusing on when technology goes wrong.
Interesting.
And it's the same with noise. You can probably trace the genealogy of noise all the way back to the earliest blues musicians.
Mm.
The reason that the sound of a overdriven guitar is so fundamental to rock music is basically because if you've ever seen a guitar amplifier, there's a knob on there that says gain.
Mm-hmm.
You turn that all the way up and the waveform of the electrical signal will basically hit the roof and the floor of what the amp is capable of handling.
Right.
And that's called clipping. It'll just clip off the top and the bottom of that waveform. So if you imagine a sine wave, you know, it's S-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine like you want the sine wave to go all the way up, but it's the ceiling, quote unquote, is too low. So it's just flat. And then right. It'll continue on its path. That's the phenomenon of clipping.
Okay.
And I think in the Kinks, their song You Really Got Me, to achieve the particular guitar tone on that, I think apocryphally anyway, somebody in the band took a razor blade and cut up the speaker of the amplifier.
Okay. I have lots of things that are firing my brain right now about yeah. this kind of thing. So Tom Morello.
Yeah.
Lead guitarist.
Rage Against the Machine.
Rage Against the Machine, Audio Slave.
A genius.
There's this YouTube video. I'll see if I can find it and link it in the description.
I probably know what the one you mean.
But it's like 20 minutes long and it's just him like talking about his technique and what he tries. And it's like, he's just taking the plug of the amp and just slightly putting it into the guitar and getting this sort of noise and whatnot. And it's just, his exploration of what that freaking instrument can do is fascinating when it's a noise. I liked that term as noise because that's kind of what it is. Just these weird sounds, but he's crafting it into a way that the human brain interprets as music.
Yeah. Tom Morello, I think might be the apotheosis of it, but the OG of that was Jimi Hendrix. He was the true innovator of using feedback.
Right.
And I would say that now the main difference is for Hendrix, the noise was a musical flourish.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of his performance. I don't want to say calling it a decoration kind of cheapens it, but you know, in his performance of the national anthem at Woodstock, where he's making all these machine gun noises and making it sound like bombs are falling, like
right,
that sort of thing was just as important to expressing what he wanted to say politically as was simply playing the national anthem at Woodstock, which is a tradition at large public gatherings from baseball games to football games and so on.
Yeah.
Which just reminds me of the Fleas' horrible national anthem rendition. Oh my God.
So the other one that comes to mind is Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of where he makes the guitar talk to David Lee Roth in that song. And then there's the other song, the Pound Cake, where he takes the power drill, you know, to it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's kind of interesting. So, but this, beyond that, though, there's a whole music genre that is like this noise thing that's far more, I don't know if I want to say extreme, but more heavy on the noise side than the traditional music side, right?
Yeah. In fact, there's something of an ethos in certain underground DIY music scenes called noise, not music.
Mm.
Because if you're making music, you're making pop, and that's commercial.
Got it. This sounds familiar.
That's more in grindcore. They're more guilty of snobbery. I say that as a grindcore fan. But yeah, I didn't do much research on the history of noise music, so yeah, I won't speak as an authority on that. But noise music is a thriving underground music genre focused on making noise to with a variety of methods. Some people use laptops. I've personally, my method was, I found out in Audacity, there's a function where you can import raw data. And I sort of did that for like a bunch of MP4s and other files, random crap I had on my computer. And that's how I made my first noise EP, which will come out eventually once the album art is finished.
Nice.
But yeah, some people are real purists about it. Most of the time, like with Lou Reed, he made the album Metal Machine Music, widely regarded as one of the worst albums of all time because it was all noise. Okay. He did that with mostly guitar feedback. But artists like Mertzbo, for example, sort of liberated it, helped liberate it from the feedback, and you could use anything as a source. And he has a whole array of pedals.
Huh.
Yeah.
So taking it back to, let's say, the Tool example.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about? You, one of the things that you said in our conversation was around the idea of noise music and the occult, or noise music and, I don't know, anything to do with sort of the devil or the occult, or, you know,
that's the demonic.
The demonic. So, what's up with that?
It's really funny that your buddy said that it seemed like their equipment was possessed by a demon, because that's pretty close to something Eugene Thacker says, who is a philosopher and media studies theorist at the New School for Social Research. I have it in my notes here, but I believe he said that it's when people like Mertzbo make music, what they're doing is they're sort of sending a signal into their array of pedals and equipment and simply letting it loop around. And oftentimes the artist interaction with their equipment beyond that point is pretty minimal. It's not them playing the music, it's the music playing itself.
Okay.
Kind of like a demon is possessing it.
Yeah.
But it's more than that. So Thacker wrote a really cool piece for the magazine, online magazine Metamute, called The Devil's Switchboard, where he talks about media theory in relation to the work of the Renaissance demonologist scholar Armando Maggi. In Renaissance angelology and Renaissance demonology, there is a necessity for intermediary spirits of some kind. So in Thomas Aquinas's philosophy, for example, angels are not only something that are spoken of in the Bible and widely believed in early Christianity and Christianity to this point, but they're a theological necessity. Because otherwise God is purely ineffable to Aquinas.
Right.
So you need spirits of what he calls the upper atmosphere to mediate between God, who is totally beyond material reality. God does not have a corporeal body, but angels do, and so do demons, and us humans, the low, the material, the dirt and the worms.
Yeah,
somebody needs to connect this great chain of being from God to worms.
Okay,
and that's part of angels' job. So angels will do things such as give signs that humans can understand. Famously, the angel Gabriel announced the Mary's pregnancy to her. And I believe that was in Luke, but do not quote me. I'm not a biblical scholar.
It's fair.
Although, yeah.
We're not either. We just read them.
Yeah. So angels are mediators. They affect order, the divine order, you might even say. This goes back to other religions and like the sort of culture that early Christianity was stewing in, which was Greek paganism.
Yeah.
Daimons, where we get the word demon from, right. Are spirits that not only mediate between humanity and the divine, in this case, the Greek gods, not God, not the Christian or the Jewish God. They are often spirits of natural forces. So the practice of augury in Roman prophecy or fortune telling, augurs, is about observing the movement of birds and predicting the future based on that. This is because diamonds are divine and diamonds control how birds behave.
Sure. Birds also being ethereal, they can fly, right?
Yeah, of course. Demons and angels are constantly harped on as spirits of the air, which again, I find very, music just being wiggly air, find very appropriate.
Yeah, that's true. I was just reading, there is, what's his name? Bart Ehrman's book.
Yeah, I love Bart Ehrman. I watch him. I watch his podcast every day.
Yeah, I'm reading his book on Heaven and Hell, the history of the afterlife or whatever that's called. And, you know, he's getting very deep into, I have a classics background. And so he's getting into the deep history of the concept of the soul or, psyche, and that the idea of that spirits and the soul are made of matter. They're made of stuff. Mm-hmm. They're actually made. They're not this sort of ethereal thing or translucent, like a ghost or whatever that we think of now, or even just an image that they really believed that there were, that according to that period of time, even Socrates and Aristotle, of course, Plato, have this concept. They understand that daimons are spirits. They're made of stuff. Their stuff is finer, more refined than this crude body that we have. And so, you know, that's why it feels like there's nothing there when you put your hand through it or that sort of thing. So I'm just I'm nerding out with you on that concept. Yeah.
No, that is cool. Because Bart Ehrman also makes the point that in Judaism, pneuma, which is a Greek word, I know, but it's referring to a Jewish concept.
Yeah.
Pneuma was your equivalent to how would we think of a spirit? But I believe it was since Pythagoras in particular, where he theorized that the soul was in fact immaterial. And he's part of the reason that the concept of the immaterial soul took off in Greek philosophy and Christianity by extension.
Yeah. You really can't have one without the other.
Right, of course.
Greeks can't have Christianity without the Greeks, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So if angels are beings of order, right, what are demons?
Chaos.
Yeah. Demons block mediation from humanity to the divine, which is why I call the essay Disunity with the Divine, because they're blockers. They're walls. Even now, if like you listen, I use a lot of white noise when I'm reading, because if I hear anything, I can't.
Yeah.
It's very good at blocking out all other sounds. It's excellent in that. So,
well, that's interesting because that's another. So diabolos in Greek is also stumbling block, right? Or to obstruct.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Huh. Wow. That's fascinating. Huh. I wonder if it seems somewhat related to Job, because of Job, where's where you get encounters with the Hebrew word, hasatan.
Yeah.
Which means adversary, opposer.
Yeah.
But he's just God's prosecutor.
Yeah.
Testing Job. He's the guy who's a possible stumbling block to Job's unity with God, which he would not achieve if he cursed God.
Right. Yeah.
Hmm. I don't know if that's an actual etymological connection or why the Greeks would have translated hasatan when they're translating the Septuagint. The Septuagint.
Yeah.
Well,
we say in history, translation is commentary.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So Thacker goes on to talk more about Armando Maggi's book, which I think was called Divine Rhetoric. I'd have to look it up. So in the work of the 16th century inquisitor, Silvestro Masolini da Priario, when you encounter his job, he was an inquisitor. Part of his job was dealing with people who are possessed by demons, right? So he wrote a manual on how to deal with that. I don't know if it dealt solely with that, but it was part of that. And he makes the interesting observation that when demons possess people, in the first place, demons are liars. You can never trust what a demon says. Satan is the father of lies, for crying out loud. And I think The Exorcist also, like, the priest is like, do not listen. The devil lies always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even like Pazuzu, when he's possessing Reagan in that movie, his behavior, he'll, you know, he opens the drawer and the priest character Damien says, did you do that? And the demon is so like elusive about it. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'll reveal myself
in time.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. I think the author of The Exorcist did quite a lot of research on exorcism for that book. Mm-hmm. So this is quite in line with what he's observing, or what he's reproducing in his art anyway. So when, according to Da Prierio, when demons possess people, they lie, they speak in tongues or glossalia, they'll vomit, things will come out of their mouth, and none of those things are true. None of those things may even communicate anything at all. So, you know, speaking in tongues, glossolalia, is babbling, basically.
Right. Okay.
And Thacker calls this hyper communication. And at the end of his essay, Thacker makes a call to draw out media theories from what we know about this. And I took up the call and I wrote an essay explaining noise is a kind of hyper communication. If you think through the history of many genres of music, noise music, I think, ultimately derives from rock, but it also has a lot to do with the ambient scene, especially in Japan.
Hmm.
It has music has a tendency to communicate less and less, or to be perceived to communicate less and less. If you think rhythmically, there's a certain point where things will get so fast that you can't dance to this. You can't feel the rhythm inside. You can't even headbang. And if you look at it, especially if you look at extreme genres of metal, like black metal or grindcore or death metal, they make use of drum patterns called blast beats, which are basically sound exactly like what you think they are.
Yeah.
It's just 16th notes played as rapidly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the effect of not turning from rhythm into more something like a drone.
Right. But it still elicits kind of like an emotional response, you know, mm-hmm. with it, right? Like, it still kind of falls within that, what percussion does. I mean, the guitarists mm-hmm. do something similar too, right? They mm-hmm. Reach that. Like you said, there's a point where you can't headbang in time to that anymore. You can't dance to it, but it elevates consciousness a little bit, you know, as you're thinking, you know, as you're getting in tune mm-hmm. with what you're hearing and whatnot.
Yeah. This is one point I made in the essay, which was extremes of speed and slowness eventually just sort of loop back in on each other. Huh. Because the way you people perceive it, like if you just had a single sustained note, just played, that's it. And if you had white noise, they're both very monolithic, have a monolithic character because no information about rhythm is communicated there.
Right.
Which is why I do relate drone music to noise music, because both are pretty, usually somewhat arrhythmic. Mertzbo does have an album where he's pretty rhythmic, and most of my favorite noise albums tend towards some kind of rhythm. But like the pure, it's just, if you get too fast, too complicated, it ends up just being this massive, big wall of stuff coming at you. And with drone music and ambient, it's kind of the same because it's just sustained. I would argue that, so in black metal, the most common technique is tremolo picking. That just means picking as fast as possible. but they're always like staying on the same chord for a very long time in certain songs. So even though it's like a genre of music that tried to be even faster, it ended up being slower.
Huh. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what's the draw for you? First off, what was it? What is it that is inspiring to you about that particular genre? And
noise or black metal?
You pick.
No, I'll go with noise.
Yeah.
What's fascinating to me about noise in particular is it's partly the passion of the people in the scene. And to me, when I make noise, I tend to think of it like I'm a painter. What I'm doing is I'm trying to draw out interesting textures. I can only put it in like sensory, like non-audio to auditory terms, different textures, different landscapes. It's kind of like what sound collage artists do.
Okay.
Part of it is the extremity. Because if you think about music on a spectrum from complete order to complete disorder, at the far total end of disorder, you'll get white noise. That is because white noise is literally just all frequencies played across all spectrums at the same volume. Or a Brownian noise. Brownian noise is named after Brownian motion, which describes the motion of particles in a fluid. Again, it's completely random. This is as noise, it is literally the limit. It is as noisy as you can get. It's quite impossible to get further.
Okay.
So to me, noise musicians, the best noise musicians either are painters who are looking for interesting textures, interesting colors, but they're people who dance on the edge of limits.
Okay.
They take up the challenge of existing at the limit of human perception.
Huh.
Making something that resembles music out of that.
And yes. So there's still some sort of architecture of order.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As thin as it may be, but it has to be there in order for the brain to interpret that correctly. Is that right? Is that, am I getting
pretty much? Yeah. And to me, the people who go straight to massive just white noise, like the French artist, I think he's French. His name is Vomir. He makes what he calls harsh noise wall.
Hmm.
It's predictably quite monotonous. So that's too far for me to actually enjoy it.
Got it.
I argue that noise music itself is a music of limits, not only in how it's produced, because like I just have a pedal here. This is like my bass overdrive pedal. Okay, so here's the gain knob over here.
Yeah.
This is how you make noise music. Turn gain all the way up. You're done. It's the limit of it's pushing technology to its limits, because technology is always breaking apart in noise and also in black metal, because the earliest black metal musicians were working with pretty dirt cheap equipment. And they would intentionally push it even further to the point where it would break sometimes. Yeah.
That's easy to see how the demonic projection onto that music could happen for people who are uncomfortable with what they're hearing and have a particular religious persuasion, you know, because like humans, we just naturally have this desire to take things or to receive things as a personification of somehow, right? That something otherworldly is trying to get at us. Is that essentially all it is, or is there more happening in the tone of it or in the construction of it? So that's one question. The other side, I'm also wondering if it's related, which it sounds like it is that whole like playing the record backwards thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And hearing the devil in that.
Yeah. You know, I didn't write much in pareidolia, although it was a thought that was going through my head at the time. I think in the first place, I'm incredibly wary of pinning down what art is for other people.
Yeah.
Because I can talk about what art is for me. I can't speak for anyone else, and I wouldn't want to anyway. But the, you know, hearing the voice of Satan in the devil, if you just sit there and listen to clipping for a long time, it might sound meditative after a while, but you might also start to hear something sort of resolve itself out of the noise, especially if you want to hear it and are looking for that.
Yeah. Okay. That's where I thought this might be going too.
Not really. I tend to, here's the thing. I tend to avoid attributing the human to this sort of music in all cases. There's
what do you mean by that?
In a lot of my noise music, even though I'm clearly the one behind the controls, I'm cutting up clips and pasting them together just because I think this part sounds cool, this part's boring, I'm gonna delete that. I want to remove any impression of the human in my music as much as possible.
Oh, okay.
And particularly in my noise music and like other like dark ambient stuff, I'm fine with people understanding that a human being made that.
But kind of like what you were saying before about where the instrument is playing itself.
Yeah. That's more Thacker's interpretation, which I thought was interesting. I thought it related. I don't know. That part of his essay, Pulse Demons, didn't particularly interest me, to be honest. I think there is something like artistically or conceptually interesting there about a sort of possession in music. I was rereading one of Nietzsche's aphorisms from The Gay Science. It was aphorism 84. Nietzsche was writing that particularly in religious ceremonies. So he, as a Greek philologist, he locates the origin of poetry in Greek religion. Like, for example, it was said that Oracle of Delphi invented hexameter, the hexameter meter in poetry. And because she's an oracle of Apollo, it appears that even Apollo is the god of music and is god of rhythm. Rhythm itself can bind fate. And, you know, often magical spells included a rhythm in order to bind demons, for example. I think I found the place. There was an even stranger notion that may have contributed most of all to the origin of poetry. Among the Pythagoreans, it appears as a philosophical doctrine and an artifice in education. But long before there were any philosophers, music was credited with the power of discharging the emotions, of purifying the soul, of easing the ferocia animi, or ferocious mind, precisely by means of rhythm. Whether the proper tension and harmony of the soul had been lost, one had to dance, follow the singer's beat. That was the prescription of this therapy. So, essentially, when one was possessed by the ferocia of a deity, particularly Dionysus, the way that you would tranquilize that deity would be through dancing and music, and you would cathartically dance the god out. And he points out etymologically, melos is the origin of the word melody, means tranquil.
Yeah.
So I think certainly music of all kinds can affect possession or affect exorcism.
Okay.
At least it did in the religious system of the ancient Greeks, according to Nietzsche.
Right.
Who knows if he was right about that? But to me, when I say that noise music is a music of limits, when I say demons are beings of the limit, there's a limit in the sense on the limit of human knowledge or human perception, because they block knowledge of God via negative mediation. And I also conceptually, demons are beings that they stand in for conceptual limits in other ways. I think Thacker actually ended up citing, I think, Elaine Pagel in Pulse Demons. Pagel wrote that others, namely pagans, Jews, and heretics, they are beings that, again, dance around a limit. Namely, this limit is the border between in-group and out-group. So pagans are beings of the outside. Jews are beings of the border. and heretics are beings of the inside. So that's yet another connection of how demons are always dancing along edges.
Hmm. Okay. That makes sense because it depends on which side you're on.
Mm-hmm.
There's still going to be a border there. And you're saying that's where the demons are dancing, so to speak, or whatever. They're along that side. Because, you know, as Pagel describes, you know, during the early Christians or the Christian movement of the first and second century, the Roman paganism was the dominant religion. And it was the Christians that were demonized, so to speak.
Right.
But, you know, when that dominant paradigm shifted, you know, that demonization went the other direction. And then of course there's the fighting in, you know, within itself and then between all these different factions of this new Jesus movement and, what was growing to be, rabbinic Judaism and that separation.
Yeah, and I would argue even today as particularly bands in the genre of extreme metal, I don't know how I would classify her, but the, I guess I'll call her like dark ambient. The artist Lingua Ignota, which means unknown tongues in Latin. So again, we're back to glossolalia and babbling. I think my buddy Sig told me about this album. Sinner Get Ready. Sinner Get Ready was an album of hers where she aesthetically engaged with sort of the horror elements or perhaps even the demonizing elements of the dominant religion of her time, which is Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funnily enough, she engages with the religious history of Pennsylvania, where I'm from, because Pennsylvania has a very, very, very long history of new religious movements. The Quakers originally settled this place.
Sure.
And we have the Amish and the Mennonites.
Yeah.
And even I went to Juniata College, which is associated with the Church of the Brethren, which is a peace church, somewhat similar to the Quakers.
Yeah. Well, and the Latter-day Saints were just right next door in New York, you know, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
very, very close proximity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a ton of black metal bands, I can't even name how many, and aesthetically engage with Christianity by demonizing it. Some like a lot of really, like, especially in early black metal, they were at least aesthetically engaging with Satan. I don't know if they were Satanists, but, you know, infamously, like, the members of Mayhem burned down churches in Norway, for like old historical stave churches. But plenty of other black metal bands will, the way they subvert Christianity is by demonizing it. So, and you can get this in different cultures as well. The Polish black metal band Batushka combines black metal with Orthodox chanting and aesthetics of Orthodox Christianity. And in this way, I think what they're doing is they're trying to turn Orthodox Christianity on its head.
Yeah.
Basically.
That makes sense.
Lyrically, like in their song, Estina, after their album Liturgia. Estina, it means truth in Old Church Slavonic. I think they take the liturgy of St. John, and which is traditionally performed in Orthodox Christianity, and everywhere that it says God or Lord, it will say I. So they're engaging in self-deification.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've seen that. I think, in modern Satanism, that seems to be also a direction where that kind of tends to go.
Yeah, yeah. I think what they're doing aesthetically there and conceptually there is really, really fascinating, which it didn't really occur to me until I looked at the lyrics of it, which is it's the beauty of music, because you listen and you're like, oh, this goes hard. And then you find out later actually doing something really interesting philosophically there. Moving on, I have more notes here. In other like philosophical conceptions of what demons are, demons are beings whose existence cannot be pinned down. They're defined by a paradox. So they're always crossing these conceptual borders, right? Mm. And, you know, these are conceptual borders that are particular to particular cultures.
Right.
I you couldn't get me to name which book she talks about this in, but Mary Douglas talks about her idea of schemes of cultural categorization, which I actually found this reading Noah Carroll's Philosophy of Horror. Dr. Carroll, if you're out there, please take me as a grad student. he wrote about this in his Philosophy of Horror, and he applied it to horror. The most terrifying as well as the most powerful beings in a given culture are the ones that violate some sort of border. So conceptual border. So lobsters, for example, is this a bug? Is this a land animal? Is this a water animal? You can't pin it down. Just steer clear of it. That thing is no good.
And why is it so tasty?
Exactly. Why is it so tasty? Which granted, the lobsters are the crabs, creepy crawlies, don't like them. In Mary Douglas's like one particular example she has is, I think flying squirrels. One particular tribe she was doing an ethnography on were terrified of flying squirrels.
Uh-huh.
Is it a bird? Is it a land animal? Whatever. It's just bad news. Steer clear of that damn thing.
Because it doesn't operate within the framework.
It breaks the rules.
Yeah, right. It doesn't fit the rules. Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it must be at least bad luck, if not worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But these things also have power because she calls it interstitiality. It might have been Carol who coined that term. But interstitiality, it's always ritual fetishes that are also always breaking these kinds of rules within the particular cultural framework that these people understood their whole world in. Which Carol argues is why like werewolves, for example, are such staples of horror monsters. Human or animal, both and neither.
Right.
That's why it's such a good monster.
Yeah. That's a really good point. It hits that sort of animalistic where, you know, evil and demons are always often associated with the beast or the, you know, animalistic thing.
The beast. And they're always made up of just a bunch of different parts jammed together, like chimeras.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. He just let his imagination run wild thinking up demons. And I think there's a famous painting of, I think it's called The Devil Presenting Vices to Saint Augustine, where Satan has green skin, big tusks, horns, bat wings, hooves, and he just has a face on his ass.
I've seen this one.
It's quite famous. And it's so bizarre, but it gets you perfectly into the mindset of how medieval people conceived of Satan.
Yeah, there is one drawback of having this podcast be audio only is there are definitely some visual elements of this that would make fantastic material. But thankfully, there are other folks out there that are doing it far better than we could. So we'll just link to those. But yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And oftentimes, again, Thacker points out in Pulse Demons, their demons cross boundaries between the one and the many. So in Luke, I believe Luke chapter 8, verse 26 to 39, and this occurs in Mark as well. There's an episode where Jesus casts demons out of a man and sends them into some pigs.
Right.
And this violates the boundary between singular and multiple, because Jesus asks, "What is your name?" And he states, "Legion, for we are many."
Yeah.
Or
interesting.
Actually, it doesn't say that. He just says legion, and then it goes on to say, "For there were many inside him."
Yeah, right. That's something I never thought of, that concept between the one and the many. So often that is where, I guess, the demonic does tend to surface, is in that because you're alone or you're not alone. And, you know, is there there's my world and then there's everything else. And I could see how that demonizing can go either direction in that regard, right? So you're the if you're the one, you're you could be demonizing someone else, and then the others who think maybe you're an outcast are demonizing you. It's something I never thought of.
Demons are beings that expose cracks in human knowledge, the flaws in how we conceive of the world, our knowledge systems, rather.
Sounds useful.
Yeah, it is. It is a useful metaphor for more than just noise music. And that what you just said reminded me of another book I read was Hideous Gnosis Black Metal Symposium number 1, because I mostly picked it up because Thacker has an essay in there, which just ended up being reprinted from one of his other books, which I had already read. But so I read some other ones. And one by the author Masciandro. Black metal conceptually is opposed to order in terms of intersubjectivity or objectivity, thereby making all discourse and communication impossible. To him, that's what black metal represents. And back to werewolves, there was another interesting essay that talked about the tendency of some black metal bands to engage with lycanthropy is both on an aesthetic and conceptual level, which she then relates to Deleuze and Guattari in A Thousand Plateaus, where they talk about one or several wolves.
Oh, interesting.
And another author, I'm just jumping around because I have all these notes here. I believe the Gothic Studies scholar, Patricia McCormack, had an interesting essay as well. Lovecraft through Deluzio, Guattari, and Gates. Deluzio and Guattari define demonic animals as animals that form a multiplicity or a becoming or some sort of tale. So in the process of what they describe as becoming animal, first the subject becomes a not subject, so they become a pack. And then this pack can interface with other packs, or assemblages is another term they use. And to McCormack and to Deleuze and Guattari, this is where creativity and freedom can enter into it. Because the thing about noise music is a thing that it'll break your conceptions of what music can be, for sure. And maybe it sounds like shit to you. I know I've played saw a lot of that stuff to my dad, and he was like, "Brendan, this sounds like shit." He didn't use those words, but he was like, "This is just noise." Like, I played him one of my favorite pieces of music, especially since it was used in Twin Peaks, was Christoph Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, which is just a terrifying, screeching sound masses. Penderecki used the term sound masses to describe it. What his method there. It's not meant to sound good.
Yeah.
It's meant to terrify you.
Mm-hmm.
But new horizons of what things can be are always terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Breaking out of the grid that was laid out for you is always scary, but there's freedom in it, and freedom is wonderful.
That's got to be what the originators of blues were experiencing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's to draw this back to where you kind of were said it, a lot of this kind of started, was that birth of the blues movement, and then of course out of that comes rock and R&B and everything. So
because blues was a minoritarian art form, it was not popular with the dominant culture of the time.
Right.
It was only popular with black people.
Yeah.
And it was created by black people.
Americans.
And it engaged
Americans specifically.
Yeah, specifically black Americans. And you know, when new music is innovated, it's rarely popular at the start.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it takes off, like in the case of blues. But even then, when these new art forms take off, people have a tendency to attribute the demonic to them, like it or not. Think about Robert Johnson's story about how did he get to play guitar so good? He met the devil at the crossroads.
Yep.
And it didn't help that he was also making this music that was pretty edgy lyrically, like Hellhound on My Trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and there's the other bit too, that I forget the official title of it. Maybe you know what it is, the 27 Club. Robert Johnson, Kurt Cobain, I forget who else.
Hendrix,
age of 27, mm-hmm. died. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, musicians famously not always very mentally or stable or healthy people.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, it's not inevitable creativity. I think the romanticizing it is bullshit and unhealthy.
I agree.
But at least in the way majoritarian cultures, our dominant culture conceives of these figures, they equate that creativity with that edginess,
right.
that unhealthiness, that self-destruction.
Which I think in truth is a lot of projection. Like,
oh yeah,
so much of what we cover on this show and you know what history bears out, again, history being predominantly written by the winners, mm-hmm. but we can still get these exciting discoveries as well, that were shoved in a cave for more than almost 2,000 years.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't Robert Johnson I don't think it was even like really appreciated until a lot of old recordings were found of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
I definitely might be wrong on that, but he was, the recordings, the equipment was primitive. So
yeah,
likely, I mean, around the time that phonographs were made, like, commercially available, the most popular genre of music was most popular musician was John Philip Sousa.
Right.
Because marches, it was played in marching bands, and that's where people experienced live music.
Yeah. Huh. That's fascinating. Well, Brendan, this has been an absolute pleasure talking. We have covered things I knew nothing about whatsoever, and I feel a lot more connected. And I have to say that I am excited that maybe I was connected with it more than I thought. That I had some familiarity with some of the things you're talking about, and you definitely enlightened on areas that I just had no idea it existed. But what an amazing journey of thinking about music and thinking about noise as music or even beyond music and what it can represent, and then tying in those models or concepts of the demonic and Satan and the demon as those edges of what did you call it? The edges of
interstitiality.
Yeah, the edges of
cultural conceptual categories. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a mouthful. I know.
Right. It is. Yeah. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
No problem. It was my pleasure.
That was cool.
I told you. I had no idea what to expect. And I said it in the interview, but I'm still amazed at how much I actually knew, and I didn't think I'd know, but it's not like I knew anything about the subject entirely itself, but the principles and the ideas that he was going around were not
new, right? Yeah. They were fairly common in the design. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing, that it was a rather consistent understanding of it, despite the fact that like I knew of Tool, but I didn't know of any of the other examples or any of the other impressions that were out there. But so here's what I expected to be perfectly honest on, even when I told you about this thing that I had read and that I had seen, I didn't get that directly from Tool. I got that out of like Rolling Stone or off of some sort of article that came out of. And so I assumed that it, like most of the information I get about the devil that's in front of the people, is this telephone game. Mm. That by the time I have an understanding or an interpretation of what's there, I'm way off. Like it's completely off from where it started. And frankly, there's a lot still that I didn't get in this one that I learned a bit about. But it was a little encouraging to know that, like, I had the general idea. Mm-hmm. And the rumors that I had been told and the directions and the sounds and the back scratching and all of that, that, like, that's all... Yeah, that was the general thought. That was what the noise music was. So it was, I just found it really interesting and a little confirming. I'm like, huh, yeah. Didn't get that one super wrong this time.
Well, my preconceived notion was off. I guess I thought that it was going to be more of like, you know, playing a track backwards and finding hidden messages type of thing. Or I don't know, if you do press record and hear back the recording and hear like little snippets of noises, mm-hmm. and try to piece them together to create messages. I thought it was going to be more like that. So, and I guess there's some of that to this as well.
Yeah.
So, but this went a very different trajectory than what I was expecting.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting about the idea of instruments and amplifiers that were super old and intentionally like driving them to the point of breaking. And that's the sort of result that they were after.
Yeah, well, when I heard what they were doing to the instruments, I was like, oh my God, they're abusing these instruments. Yeah. they are pushing them to their breaking point. So
Yeah. And I mean, but that's nothing new, right? I mean, musicians have been doing that for ages.
Yeah. Forever.
I did have the... You know, a bit of the skeptic science in me of going, well, of course, when you change the shape, when you change the matter, when you change how it was held and what the vibrations can do, you're going to create new sounds. It's mm-hmm. going to have it do its own thing. But
of course,
the idea of it being, I almost call it a natural, but really a degradating of what it was.
Yeah.
To create this ongoing sound and listen to it evolve and it's changing. Mm. That is really fascinating. I didn't get in my interpretation, like that wasn't necessarily a cause for the messages or anything like that coming out of it, but definitely just the newness of it, right? The new sound, which the way I relate it is like, oh yeah, this is like using feedback. Like mm-hmm. now we have an instrument that can do feedback. What does the feedback do? And all of that.
And how that contributes to the music. I mean, and the whole idea of the instrument playing itself.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
You know, and it makes sense. And for me, you know, and then with the whole skeptic thing, you're like, oh, well. You know, you get it. You could see how that works. And maybe the amp turned itself on. Maybe it didn't, you know, as far as Tool goes. Maybe they turned it on and just recorded and see what they could get. Who knows?
Right. Or the power strip just like clicked because the rocker was half there.
I wanted to hear more like actual like devil stuff. I wanted it to tie in a little bit more to like actual like demons or the devil or Satan giving messages. I do like, yes, the devil, chaos, you know, mm-hmm. Unordered. Yes, this noise music is also like that, but I wanted more like...
Yeah,
you wanted more ordered.
Yes, something specific. More ordered. I wanted those messages of like, oh, what are we going to hear type of thing, so, you know, from the underworld or whatever, Hollywood type of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And you guys even mentioned The Exorcist, mm-hmm. right? Things like that. So that's, I was a little disappointed that I didn't get more of that from it. But again, my preconceived notion was a whole different trajectory than what this was. But it was okay. It was a great interview.
Thank you. Yeah. It was not knowing what to expect. It just kind of went down a path that was really interesting, and I didn't know where it was going to go, you know. Maybe that's evident. I don't know. But but I appreciated, you know, I think he was talking about the scholar Eugene Thacker that was discussing the whole idea of, I'm trying to remember the term that he used, but, you know, demonology and the noise music and that sort of thing. And it got really academic, right? You know, about the concepts of where the devil is. And maybe I'm mixing this up with one of the other people that he mentioned too, but it's how my brain is piecing this together right now. You know, the devil or the demons dancing on the edges of, dancing on the edges, right?
Like, I'm trying to remember that part.
So it was the idea that that, you know, the chaos is always, or that line that separates either, like, could be the self versus everything else, or everything else versus that one guy. There's that, the
right.
Yeah,
yeah. And the demons are on the outside of the definition of the line.
Yeah,
is that the one, the definition?
Exactly. They're like right on the line, and it can go either direction, you know. So demonizing happens in either case, and it just sort of brought me back to thinking about the evolution of rock and blues and all of that as being the devil's music, right? And how long that has progressed. And he brought up John Philip Sousa, which I thought was really interesting, you know, as the time as blues was being, you know, invented and created, that, you know, marching music was how you listened to live music at the time.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What are your takeaways? What are your thoughts?
So for me, I kind of had a moment where I was recognizing that I had a judgment around what I considered to be noise music and just noise. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting that I have to have it in a particular production style or level for it to be music in my head, when all of it is, you know, technically reverberating on itself and doing its own things. But I noted for a little bit that, like, even in this chaotic sound and this study of what we can create and can make out of it, I still have a preference. I still have like a, no, this is right, no, that's wrong. Rather than just, it's all the same thing. And so that was kind of my walk away. I'm just like, all right, yeah, so I like electric things. That's fine. And that's okay. It doesn't mean the other stuff isn't. It's just, that was my big ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the concept of noise music or that sort of hard genre. I've certainly listened to grindcore and black metal and death metal before, and it's extreme. And I thought, you know, his observation of when something is so fast, it becomes slow.
Yeah.
Was really interesting, because that just tells me something about how the brain is interpreting what it's receiving, right? And how it makes sense of the disorder, right?
I was immediately reminded of one of my daughter's friends who mentioned that she loves to go to sleep to metal. Mm. She like, Zoe listens to wave sounds and like, or rather like sleep stories and whatnot. But her friend's like, no, I just like heavy metal. Like, as soon as you turn it on, turn on the lights, like I immediately go to sleep. And that was exactly where my brain was going. It's like, right, because it gets so fast, it just turns into this slow right? This really, suddenly it's just this mellow thing that for her was a white noise.
Yeah.
And that's what just knocks her out.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Isn't that wild? That's what I was thinking about when I heard it. I just immediately related it.
Oh, my kids just get elated when they listen to like hardcore stuff with, you know, those fast beats and stuff, like heavy metal music. They love it. They get excited. They don't get angry. They are, you know, or tired or whatever. The emotion that is brought out for them. And you, Don, you mentioned this type of music elicits an emotional response for my kids. It's just pure joy. They're just bouncing around all over the place.
Yeah.
So that's like the opposite of being tired. I can't even imagine.
So. Well, it comes back to art, right? And mm-hmm. art being in the eye of the beholder, in a sense.
Oh, sure. And he even said, you know, I'm not going to interpret somebody else's art for them, you know. Certainly noise music is not something I listen to often. I
or ever again.
Forever. I listened to some when I found out that that's what we were going to be discussing today. And it's not for me. It's not my cup of tea. For others, it is. And, you know, I'm not going to rain on their parade. But it's just that's something that I had no idea about. And would I call it music? For me personally, no. And Jeremy, you were talking about the line of noise music versus just noise. To me, it just sounded more noise.
But that's a judgment call, right?
And that is my judgment call. That's not, again.
Yeah.
When I hear it, I'm not picking up what others are getting out of it. And I kind of wish I was. I want to see.
Yeah.
And understand more.
I listened to Brennan's track, which is called Adrenochrome Junkie, which I thought was really poignant. I loved that. You know, if you recall Adrenochrome from the Satanic Panic podcast, that episode that we did. And I mean, I'm there with you in that it just sounds like a series of noise and I can't make any sense of it. And it is disorder. One thing I did find, though, towards the end of his piece anyway, is that there were noises from video game systems of my childhood, and it elicited an emotional response from me. I'm like, oh, I remember that noise. That noise meant something at some time. I tried to think about what he said about textures and trying to listen to the soundscape of the composition from like a texture and, that sort of thing. And it's very difficult for anyone who is not accustomed to thinking about this from a art form.
Yeah, I would argue that, again, you guys know me, the way I see the world is visually, and mm-hmm. so my thought process comes out visually. So whenever I hear things, whenever I go through different levels of music or speech, I see it in different waveforms. And that's so much what this was for me.
Yeah.
Which, again, kind of made that the distinction. Like, I saw some that were like, this is just white and black lines all over the place. This is just a wobble of sound, as opposed to this one, which has textures is a great word for it. I was thinking color lines and waves and different effects. And they don't do it all in like a harmony wave. Like they're scattered, but they're definable. And I was able to pick elements out and go, oh, I like that. I like how that did those things there. And right. And now it's music to me because I'm seeing things differently for that particular song. But like, I totally get what you're saying.
Does that get overwhelming for you? Like, especially with the chaotic noises and you being so visual, you're hearing it and visualizing it. So yeah. At the same time, is that just completely overstimulating for you? And like, do you need a break?
That's a really good question. I would say that I have to certainly limit what tasks I'm doing. Like, I couldn't do this while driving. Like this is something, this is a kind of sound set that I would not be able to have in the background because I wouldn't be able to focus on everything I'm doing on the road. Whereas, right, like an audiobook or a familiar track of music I can listen to and sing to. Never get the words right. I don't do words, but the sounds, I can connect to those while driving. This would be too much. So I would say in that level, it's overwhelming. Otherwise, I wouldn't necessarily recognize that I'm being overwhelmed, other than the fact that I'm probably just sitting still. So yeah, I would say I'm probably being overstimulated and shutting down, and that my eyes are glazing over. I'm not interacting with anything because I'm just feeling and seeing so much.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's a really interesting observation. I didn't even think of it like that, but that's where I would have told you I'm just sitting and listening to the music. It's mostly being in the stimulation, and too much would have knocked me out of it.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. It reminds me of the common experience of, you know, the parents yelling at their teenagers, turn off that noise.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And how many generations and different music types were considered noise to others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nonsensical. Whereas it has evolved to be, I think that what we're dealing with today, particularly in what, Brennan and what he's trying to represent or put forth. And obviously he very similar to others that we've had on the show where it's like, hey, it's very, very clear. One person can't represent the whole genre or the group or whatever, you know? So this is just his understanding of it. And his understanding is so much more than mine or, you know, obviously yours. So it was really, really insightful to kind of go through that journey though. And then the one thing that I was thinking about was the uncomfortableness of experiencing noise and or music that might be interpreted as noise, as, you know, see previous example,
yeah,
parents yelling at their kids, and how your judgment or your preconceived notions would be projected upon that as evil.
Yeah, that's real interesting. You know, I'm going to relate it back just the other way a little bit, because as the parent with the kids, all of their music is my music at the moment, right?
Sure,
it's all my influence on them. But in reverse, my parents had a whole genre of music that they were a fan of that I couldn't get around at all. And I was the cranky old man at 12 years old. What is this noise? This is terrible. What is the Carpenters? That's an awful idea. Why would you put that on? Debbie Boone who? Like I had my own level of just squeaky, whiny, prepubescent complaints all the time around music that for them is a memory and something that they connected to. But right from those same parents back and forth, when I found something and I was like, oh, this one lets me have emotions. Mm. This one lets me connect to how I feel. And they immediately are like, that sounds evil. Mm-hmm. That sounds like it's too much, because it triggered an emotional response in them too, but it's one that they didn't want to feel. And that was part of where they were really feeling the like, this is bad. Because it was letting me get my my aggression out, my just all of my need to express happened a lot there that way.
Yeah, I mean that's what I feel like. Why I love heavy metal and why I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with it is just that sort of charged emotional response that it can evoke. And if you are experiencing that, and that's not a thing you like to experience, particularly from that source.
Yeah.
I could see where, again, that's where I just feel like all these projections come in, and then you get out what you bring with you.
For sure. Yeah.
My son wrote a metal song.
Hell yeah.
Yes.
It's so fun, you guys. He recorded it on his phone. It's just him singing and headbanging and stuff. But this is what you get. This is what you get. I love it so much. I love it. I love it.
That's fantastic.
It's the greatest.
So, Don, what was your big takeaway? What was the thing that got you the most on it?
You know, I'm thinking in terms of the sounds that can make you uncomfortable and what you do in response to that. And by sounds, obviously, in referring to an art form of noise, music, but that being in many forms. So he talked about Jimi Hendrix and being able to make that sound of machine guns through the guitar, and that's being a kind of noise. And you know, he, like you said, he kind of uses the feedback as a flourish, whereas Tom Morello is exploring the hell out of what all the different components of the guitar can actually do to create a sound and a soundscape that is totally definitely noise. But he does it in within a rhythm and a tone that fits with the song and the intonality and just the actual music that he's crafting.
Yeah.
But that can still create this sense of uncomfortableness and people bringing their judgments to that. But then, you know, carrying that over to the extreme of actual, you know, the noise music genre, where someone like myself or like what, you know, the two of you have expressed, it's just very difficult to make sense and appreciate it from this is something that I would listen to. I am thankful to have heard about it and how it is made and why it is made than just going in cold, because that I think would be a bad idea.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. And I'll admit there was a little bit of that on my end, right? Other than the anecdotes I've held in the background, I didn't do a lot of the pre-search or pre-listening before the interview. I kind of hit it cold. Mm-hmm. And I think, for me, I'll agree with you. I think that spoken, it influenced kind of my reaction to it and the questions that you had asked and the stories back and forth. I didn't want to take over your point. I just wanted to agree with you. Like, going in cold was probably not the best way to approach it.
Well, as in, if you went and listened to music cold without having listened to the interview first, I guess.
Okay, got it. Yeah. So I dodged it then. I didn't do that.
Good for me. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I think it's interesting. And then I also think it's very interesting just conceptually around where we find the demonic and the angels in that path of the musical journey of noise, and where it's always on the fringe. You know, blues was on the fringe of what was considered music, and then that involved, you know, to R&B, and, you know, then you have different class lines or race or whatever it might be that creates that divide between certain specific music, and again, there's that the demons are dancing on the divide, the edge of what is order versus chaos. And all the baggage that goes with putting your values on interpreting that. But then that carries over to, you know, this very interesting piece that Brendan has crafted, which again was very nonsensical for me and till the end, when I was like, oh, I remember, you know. And so did I make any sense out of anything?
Did the devil speak to you?
The devil did not speak to me. There was no words, but I think I get it a little bit more, like 1% more than I did before talking with him, which I think that's all I'm after. 1%. I'm happy.
Yeah. Did I mention Wendy Sisko the last time we all got together? I feel like I brought it up with you too.
The name sounds familiar.
Wendy Sisko is big time composer. And you mentioned Exorcist, which is why it came up for me. Mm-hmm. Wendy Sisko did The Shining, and she did Tron. And before she did both of those, she kind of invented electronic music.
Mm,
okay. Because she was able to play with waveform designs and determine, like, when I create this electronic sound, it does this form. And I had so many different moments throughout the creation of sounds. Tom Morello, it was the part that brought it up the most for me. But the electronic music that I enjoy, that I have learned to enjoy, found through techno and through Tron and through so many other things that I didn't know Wendy Sisko was the composer of and creator of until I found out recently, just a couple of months ago, like just the huge influence that she has on the industry. Still making music, by the way, still heavily in it.
Oh, awesome.
And I just had so much appreciation then that I was like, all right, cool. Electronica for life. I'm here for that. Right. In the video game towns. And so that was part of it, back to what I was saying earlier, feeling that I have a very clear genre distinction of noise versus noise music, because I already have that level of appreciation that's already been built in for the electronica sound. Mm-hmm. And there's so many times that you'll hear, you know, the wash come through or the feedback warble or so many of the things that are supposed to create different feelings or different textures in the song, mm-hmm. that happen with the rhythm and the beats that happen in electronica. And so my takeaway from this one was recognizing that it's not just the one style. There literally is this immeasurable amount of ways that noises can come together and music can be created, and people can appreciate it in whatever form it shows up as. And it doesn't have to match my style, and certainly doesn't have to be in a film or on an album to qualify for any of that. But I don't know. I'm so used to the idea of opening my horizons, right? And like listening with learning and really getting something out of it, especially after this podcast. There's so many different times I pick things up. And I want to learn, and I'm still happy to do that. But I was very clear. I had that moment of just like, nah, I'm good. I like that one. That worked out for me. And it's fine. I definitely had a, I don't want to say snobby. It didn't feel snobby to me at the time, but I was very clear that I was like, I like this. I don't like that in that part. So it was really cool to learn more about it and to learn things around what it could be and where it could go. I didn't listen, I'll be honest, with the ear of The Devil You Don't Know so much in this one. Even with the questions that you had came through and the ones that brought up, I was still mostly in like the, again, visualizing and the science of it.
Yeah. It's a very different episode than we've done before. So
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even Brendan talks about snobbery and the different parts of the music community and even in what he's talking about. Right. So, and I, again, go back to appreciating he's not going to interpret it somebody else's art and, let it sort of speak for itself. Cause that's the intent and all that stuff. So very exciting. Well, this is just the first of several interviews we're going to do this season. Up next is our very close friend, Chris Odey.
All right.
I have already done the interview. It's awesome. Chris is great to talk with, and I can't wait to share that with you. I haven't decided if I'm going to call the episode The Devil and Chris Odey. I really want to. but the devil doesn't... is not a prominent figure in the conversation, but we do talk about it. It's just not as central. And it fits because, spoiler alert, if you're not Lutheran, Lutherans don't really talk about the devil very much. And that's, I think, relatively true for a lot of what I've talked about, mainstream or liturgical churches, churches that were Protestant churches that were sort of spun off from Catholicism. So I found that they tend to drift more politically liberal, and you find the devil in a significantly diminished, if even visible, role, shows up in liturgy once in a while.
Yeah. In all the years I listened to my dad's sermons, I do not ever remember him, you know, telling us about the devil.
But I thought it would be interesting to gain Chris's perspective for a couple of things. One, he is an ordained pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And he's going to unpack what that actually means, which is really great. And he is in the pursuit of a psychology degree, and in particular, school psychology. So, and he's always been, I feel like he and I have a lot in common in the way we think. And there's definitely some things that we don't agree on in this interview. And I'm excited to talk to you about that. And it's not, there's no confrontation. It's just a very interesting sort of differences of opinion of how you go about
and
things.
And Don and Chris are no longer friends.
It's not true. I'm very excited to have him on the show again, in fact. So, anyway, so that's coming up. And then, of course, we've got a few Pope podcasts out there that want to talk about the devil and popes and stuff. So that'll be coming. And
nice.
Yeah. So like lots to come. Stay tuned. And remember that the devil you don't know is the devil someone else does. Have a good night, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
And now for the disorder of your listening, used here with permission of Brendan Foster, by the way. This is, in its entirety, Adrenochrome Junkie by Brendan Foster.